Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the first regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We're in session 19, Israel Present. So let's go ahead and review where we were in session 18. Last time, we started with 1991, when Iraq attacks Israel with ground-to-ground missiles during the Gulf War. Under American and Soviet auspices, the Middle East Peace Conference then followed. It was convened in Madrid, Spain. And the results of the Madrid conference were basically two parties talks between Israel and Lebanon. The goal was a peace treaty. That did not happen. There's still no peace treaty even today. Two party talks between Israel and Syria. Again, a peace treaty was a goal, but that has never happened even till today. And the next two party talks was between Israel and Jordan, and a peace treaty was accomplished on October 26, 1994. And the last two-party talk was between Israel and the Palestinians to begin with transitional self-government, and then that would go on for 5 years, and after the transitional self-government period was finished, then they would talk about permanent self-government arrangements. In 1992, Israel began diplomatic relations with China and India. A new government came to power, headed by Yitzhak Rabin of the Labor Party. And under Rabin's leadership, there was the limited Palestinian self-rule agreement was instituted. Here you can see Rabin on the left. Current president was Clinton. And then Arafat on the right. In 1994, the Gaza-Jericho agreement was signed. And here we have King Hussein of Jordan on the left. Bill Clinton in the center, and then Yitzhak Rabin on the right, signing the Israel-Jordan Peace Treaty Agreement. In 1994, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Arafat, Peres, and Rabin. And unfortunately, Hamas suicide bombers were very active. And this is a Hamas suicide bomber. But unfortunately, there were some acts of Jewish terrorism as well. The most famous consisted of Dr. Baruch Goldstein, and when he attacked the worshippers in the Hebron Mosque. Kiryat Shmona was consistently rocketed by Hezbollah in the north. In fact, many of the northern settlements and kibbutzim and cities were receiving fire from Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Oslo II Accord was signed in the White House. Oslo II gave Area A, the Palestinian cities, that responsibility for those cities was given to the Palestinian Authority. Area B was the Palestinian villages. That area was given authority to the Palestinians. And Area C remained under Israeli sovereignty with Israeli settlement, military areas, and state lands. So the plan is to gradually expand Palestinian occupation of the West Bank till most of it was given to the Palestinians. We'll see how that goes in just a little bit. Then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated and Shimon Peres became the acting Prime Minister. Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by Yigal Amir. And here is the new Prime Minister, Shimon Peres. In 1996, the first Palestinian elections were underway, and Arafat was elected president, as would be expected. Shimon Peres guided Israel to Operation Gates of Wrath, which was a military operation designed to curb or eliminate Hezbollah to the north. Unfortunately, it turned out to be quite a failure. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu narrowly defeated Shimon Peres in the next election and became prime minister. In 1997, we looked at the fact that the modern Zionist movement was 100 years old. The 1997 date geared from the 1897 date in Basel, Switzerland, of the first Zionist Congress. So at that time, we reviewed a couple of subjects that we dealt with way, way back in one of our first sessions. What is Zion and what is Zionism? So we began with what in the world is this word Zion anyway? And then we went on to what is Zionism, and we took a look at Zionism from the world's perspective. It is a forbidden heresy, said the ultra-Orthodox. It is racism, said the UN. It is a satanic counterfeit, said a Christian anti-Semite. And it's a vicious political movement, say the Palestinians. Is that really what Zionism is? Not according to the Bible. The biblical definition would be something like this. Zionism is the Jewish longing and yearning for our homeland. Well, that brings us to the new material. And now Ehud Barak becomes the leader party head. A year after Israeli voters drove it from power, the Labor Party bid anew for the premiership by anointing Ehud Barak, a tough-minded general, as the standard bearer. Barak, 55, held a comfortable lead in the balloting in the early morning hours for the job of leading his battered party to elections in the year 2000. On his way to victory, he nudged aside former Prime Minister Shimon Peres. So he is Israel's most decorated soldier. He possesses savvy and self-confidence. He's respected for his integrity and his tell-it-like-it-is style. He embodies clarity and precision, traits that the Israeli public find lacking in most politicians, especially at a time of great domestic uncertainty. Ehud Barak was born in the Mediterranean coastal kibbutz of Mishmar HaSharon in 1942 of Eastern European immigrants. Barak has held most senior positions in the Israeli army, including chief of military intelligence and the head of what the soldiers call the unit, the elite Sayeret Matkal Commando Force. He won the Distinguished Service Medal, Israel's highest military honor, with 4 citations, 2 for operations that are still secret. In 1972, he led a team of commandos disguised as airport maintenance men who stormed a Belgian airliner that had been hijacked to Israel. Among the commandos at Barak's side during that particular raid was Benjamin Netanyahu, now head of the opposition Likud party. So it's very ironic that these two soldiers would now find themselves at opposite ends of the political spectrum. The next year, Barak donned a woman's wig, and he slipped into Beirut, part of a commando team that gunned down 3 leaders of the Palestine Liberation Organization. In 1988, he orchestrated the assassination in Tunis of the PLO's top military strategist, Abu Jihad, considered by Israel to be the mastermind of the Intifada, the Palestine uprising in the occupied territories. So that's the lowdown on Ehud Barak. July 29, 1997, the peace talks resume, but so did the violence. So the next day, July 30, 1997, was the Mahane Yehuda bombing. September 4, 1997, the Ben Yehuda Street bombing, 2 very serious bombings in Israel. Then on September 26, the PA began to crack down on the terrorists, and on the 29th, the peace talks resumed. Now, we come to December 10, 1997, the day when the anti-witnessing bill was proposed. So let's take a look at that. Former Minister of Telecommunications, Shash, Knesset member, the Shash is the Orthodox religious party, Shash Knesset member Rafael Pinchazi proposed to the plenum that it consider the presentation of a bill which would forbid all forms of proselytizing in Israel, as well as conversion from any faith to another. The subject was referred to further consideration to the Committee of Internal Affairs, which met in January 13th. The sum of that committee's deliberations are as follows. Number one, the Jewishness of the State of Israel is paramount to its democratic commitments. But listen to this. Freedom to convert from Judaism is a threat to the Jewishness of the state. So the committee admitted that they wanted democratic values in Israel, but not the value of freedom from religion. Freedom of religion, I should say. But not the value of freedom of religion. And of course, many Israelis are atheists, and many of them want freedom from religion. But anyway, that would be converting from Judaism would be considered illegal. That was their idea. Secondly, missionaries are repeatedly accused of using illicit materials to procure promises of conversion. Therefore, restrictions must be imposed on their freedom to present their message. Thirdly, they stated that if If a bill in the spirit of the discussion was presented to the committee, it would review it with favor. Fourthly, the committee will ask the Attorney General to advise it on the course of its next meeting on the subject as to which steps it should take and what form the bill should or could take. Eventually, the bill did come under discussion in the Knesset by passing its preliminary reading on May 20, 1998. The terms of the proposed law forbid illegal possession of literature in which there is any form of effort to persuade another to change his religion. The point, you can't own evangelistic material. That would be illegal. Secondly, the proposed law further forbids the printing or copying of such literature, so you can't produce evangelistic literature under this bill. It would be illegal. Thirdly, the proposal forbids the distribution of information, tracts, books, or means of dissemination of information. So you would be illegal to distribute evangelistic literature. The proposed law illegalizes any notice of an activity or literature in which an appeal is made for the recipients to alter their religious opinions. So point four is you can't advertise. It'd be illegal to advertise evangelistic activities. And the fifth point, the proposal forbids any form of effort to persuade another to change his religion. In other words, you can't present the gospel verbally. So it's a pretty comprehensive law there. The penalty for breaking this law would be 3 years imprisonment or a 50,000 shekel fine. That's approximately 10,000 American dollars. I think you can see that if such a law was passed, it would render illegal almost all evangelical activity in Israel. Now, a protracted letter writing campaign from around the world caused the bill to stall in the Knesset, and being a private member's bill, when Pinchasi did not return to the Knesset, the bill died. Very fortunately, I did not mourn its death. All right, 1998, Israel is 50. So we're going to go to and take a look at Israel then and now through some statistics, just quickly through some statistics. We'll start with total population. In 1948, the total population was 1,173,900 Jewish people. Period. The Jewish people made up 86% of that total. In 1998, the population was 5,759,400, and the Jewish people made up 80% of that total. In regard to military advancement, in 1948, Israel possessed 80 tanks. In 1998, 4,300. That's a big jump. What about warplanes? In 1948, Israel had 55. In 1998, 4,488. And the active armed forces had gained quite a bit, too. In 1948, 45,000 people were in the armed forces. In 1998, 175,000 were active in the armed forces. Now, what about the private life? Well, telephone lines, kind of an indicator of prosperity. 17,000 in 1948, 2,539,000 in 1998. And automobiles, cars, another indicator of personal prosperity, I guess, because they cost a bit to buy those things. In 1948, 9,578. In 1998, that was 1948. 1998, 1,174,166. And so finally, native Israeli Sabras. In 1948, Sabras made up 26.3% of the total population. 1998, that had risen to 61.2% of the total population. So in the 50 years of its existence, Israel had made quite a number of gains. All right, let's move to the pluralism fight, the culture war that's going on in Israel in 1998. Another indicator of the changes and struggles that impact the daily life of 50-year-old Israel is the religious pluralism fight that rages. It is a literal culture war. From the Shomron News Service, Thursday, June 26, 1977, we read this. Stop the Haredim demonstration. The Haredi Jews are the ultra-Orthodox. Stop the Haredim demonstration. A planned demonstration scheduled to be held Saturday evening in Rabin Square, Tel Aviv, has caused an outcry by Orthodox and non-Orthodox members of the Knesset and public officials. The Chukah LeYisrael organization has taken a full-page advertisements in the newspapers and paid for distribution of billboards nationwide for the Stop the Charedim demonstration. The ads read, "Stop the Charedim, they burn flags, they insult the IDF, destroy our legal government, system, and take advantage of government funds. This cannot continue. This is our land." So these are the secular Israelis rising up voicing their opinion against the ultra-Orthodox. Another sore spot is the unwillingness of the Orthodox to recognize the legitimacy of the Reform and Conservative branches of Rabbinic Judaism. This was highlighted by the controversial conversion bill fight that began in 1997 and continued on into 1998. In April of 1997, the Knesset passed the first reading of the bill giving the Orthodox establishment sole authority over all conversions to Judaism in Israel. The conservative and reform branches were incensed because the action cast doubt on the legitimacy of their Jewishness. A committee, the Ne'eman Committee, was formed. It consisted of representatives from all branches of Judaism. The committee worked out a compromise consisting of a joint conversion institute. However, Israel's chief rabbinate rejected the idea of working with non-Orthodox parties to create such an institute. And so it goes. In Israel, representatives of the Reform and Conservative movements said that this ruling that the Rabbinical Council had made declared war on Reform and Conservative movements. And that fight still rages today. Here is a picture of the pluralism fight. This is probably some kind of a demonstration going on in one of the cities in Israel. And here you see this Haredi guy, this ultra-Orthodox guy, in the clutches of this atheistic policeman. This policeman does not look religious in any way, shape, or form, and he doesn't look very happy with the guy that is religious. Of course, we don't know the issue that caused them to grapple like that. But that's symbolic of it. And the pluralism fight is shown here with this ultra-Orthodox guy being led away by the police. This was because of some kind of a demonstration that he was involved with. So it goes on. The fight still rages today. The beat goes on. Y River Memorandum signed. On October 15th, 1998, a trilateral summit was hosted by President Bill Clinton of the United States at Y River, Maryland, for the purpose of moving the peace process forward between Israel and the Palestinians. And here's a picture of the negotiations going on. Madeleine Albright, I believe she was our Secretary of State, is in the center, Benjamin Netanyahu on the left, and Yasser Arafat on the right. So there's the ongoing negotiations there. I'm a little early on my slide there. The following summary is a text of the agreement. Number one, a transfer of territory and redeployments of IDF forces in two stages. Secondly, a third redeployment committee will be established. Thirdly, continuous combating of terrorism infrastructure would be taken on. Fourth, security arrangements were discussed. Fifth, Palestinian collection of illegal weapons would occur. Seventh, there would be a ban on incitement to violence. There was a reduction in the Palestinian police force to reduce the police force to the size specified in prior agreements. Eighth, there would be a public nullification of the anti-Israel clauses in the PLO charter. That had still not happened, even though the PLO said that would happen. It had not by this time. Permission was granted to build an airport, seaport, and industrial park in Gaza. There would be safe passage between the West Bank and Gaza, and this was all take place on a 12-week timetable. So then on November 18, 1998, the Knesset approved the Y River Memorandum. And then on October 26, 1998, the Y River Memorandum was signed. And here you can see Yasser Arafat on the left signing his portion of the agreement. Next to him is King Hussein of Jordan. And you notice that he is quite bald. That's because of his chemotherapy. King Hussein was dying at this point, and he was receiving chemotherapy for a cancer. I don't know what type of cancer he suffered from, but it would take his life shortly. Then there's Bill Clinton, initialing, signing the agreement, and then to his right, Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, on November 20th, 1998, the redeployment began. The redeployment of Israeli troops from the Jenin area of the West Bank began after the cabinet voted to implement the first stage of the 12-week redeployment. All right, let's move to another subject. The ultra-Orthodox attack the Christian community. A succession of attacks against Christians and Messianic Jews by ultra-Orthodox mobs has prompted local church leaders to call for better government protection for Israel's Christian community. Charles Kopp, chairman of the United Christian Council in Israel, demanded immediate action by Israeli authorities in late November to prevent ultra-Orthodox mob violence against Christians and Messianic Jews. The current situation in Israel cannot be allowed to continue, he said. In a November 28th incident in the Negev town of Beersheba, rumors were spread in synagogues that Messianic Jews planned to baptize Jewish children. A mob estimated by police to number 1,000 Haredim, ultra-Orthodox Jews, started to surround a Christian and Missionary Alliance church rented by the local congregation of Messianic Jews for their Shabbat, their Sabbath gathering. The 40 believers already inside the building could not get out, forcing police to evacuate them and provide protection from the crowd. Others who were still outside were blocked from entering. According to members of the congregation, they were pelted with stones, spit at, and many of their cars damaged. Angry demonstrators also attempted to climb the wall surrounding the building. Nata Aridan, a history professor at Ben-Gurion University, described the latest attack to the Jerusalem Post as reminiscent of the anti-Semitic attacks in Eastern Europe. Quote, "I witnessed a pogrom," he said. "There can be no other word for it." Isn't that interesting? The ultra-Orthodox Jewish people participating in a pogrom against other Jewish people. Really kind of ironic. The siege lasted for about 3 hours, and the crowd only disseminated after being addressed by local rabbis. Now, previously, the windows of a local Bible shop were smashed 4 times, and the shop itself set fire on once. And here is the mob scene outside the Beersheba congregation on December 25th, 2005. You can see there's quite a good number of people gathered there outside the walls of that church. And here are the police speaking to agitators in the mob, trying to keep the lid on everything. On November 11th, another ultra-Orthodox mob attacked the home of 3 Swiss Christian women in the conservative Mea Shearim neighborhood of Jerusalem, totally smashing their belongings. Only one of the 3 women was home at the time of the attack, and she had to be escorted to safety by police under a barrage of stones and bottles. Ultra-Orthodox sources accused the women of missionizing, a claim the women denied. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported on November 29th that an American couple in Kiryat Malachi was attacked recently by ultra-Orthodox youths who suspected the couple of missionary work. The couple held that they were only involved in humanitarian work among Ethiopian immigrants. A member of a Nazareth congregation was also threatened recently. His front window smashed and silicone put in the door lock of their meeting hall, according to the Messianic Action Committee. The chairman of that is Paul Lieberman. In Tiberias, Yad La'achim, an ultra-Orthodox anti-missionary organization, has denounced the Galilee Experience to the Ministry of Tourism, accusing them of illegal missionary activity. Now they do. The Galilee Experience do present the gospel to Israelis, but it's done totally above board and legally. And here's the Galilee Experience website. It's, if you ever get to Israel, I don't know if it's still functioning or not, but it's well worth going to the Galilee Experience. This is their building on the Tiberias waterfront. 1999, ultra-Orthodox attacks on believers continue throughout 1999. In March 1999, assailants threw 3 firebombs at a house on Moshava Migdal near the Sea of Galilee. Police speculate that the reason for the attack is that a member of the house belonged to a Jewish messianic sect. March 1999, the Baptist bookshop in Jerusalem was firebombed. Also in March 1999, two incendiary bombs were thrown at the apartment of Yosef Shulam, head of the Messianic community Nativia in Jerusalem. On the bright side, two incidents were encouraging. In June 1999, Yediot Acharonot reported that the leader of an attack on an apartment owned by Christians in Mea Shearim was sentenced to 18 months in prison. The judge ruled that the residents were attacked because of their faith. August 1999, the Messianic Action Committee was officially recognized as an Israeli not-for-profit organization. The MAC led the fight against the proposed laws meant to make Messianic Judaism illegal in Israel. Both of these bills failed to become law in the land. The recognition means that the Israeli government officially recognizes Messianic Judaism. February, George King Hussein dies. Did I get rid of my notes too soon there? Yes, I did. From Israeline, Monday, February 8, 1999, President Ezer Weizmann headed an Israeli delegation of 21 dignitaries who joined world leaders in paying final homage to King Hussein of Jordan. And here is King Hussein when he was in better health. Haaretz reported that Weizmann, upon hearing of the monarch's health, depicted Hussein as one who was considered an enemy for many years, but who stepped towards peace at the right moment and the right time to become Israel's best friend in the Middle East. Israel Radio, Kol Yisrael, reported that the Jewish National Fund has decided to plant a forest in memory of King Hussein, and Israel's Stamp and Medal Agency announced that it will be issuing a commemorative medal in honor of the king's memory. He is succeeded by Prince Abdullah. So here is the new King of Jordan, King Abdullah. In March, Prime Minister Netanyahu began talks with Abdullah in Amman. Abdullah confirmed support for ties with Israel with the statement, "Peace is a strategic option for Jordan." All right, May 1999, Barak landslide. From Israeline, May 8, 1999, one Israel's leader. Now, one Israel is a new political party. It was an alliance of labor and two minor parties. One Israel's leader, Ehud Barak, experienced a landslide victory over opposition leader Netanyahu. The margin of victory was 56% to 44%. The 57-year-old Barak will be Israel's 15th prime minister. All right, AIPAC drops opposition to a Palestinian state. AIPAC stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Reversing a long-standing policy during its 40th annual conference, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee dropped its opposition to a Palestinian state. The pro-Israel lobbying group took action to align with a more mainstream position and promote agreement with Israeli leaders' stance on the issue. Noting that the Labor Party no longer opposes a Palestinian state and that Foreign Minister Ariel Sharon accepts its inevitability. In June 1999, President Clinton vetoes moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. Thanks a lot, Bill. Hezbollah attacks continue. In July, Barak restarts the peace process, again from Israel line. July 19, 1999, Prime Minister Ehud Barak called for breakthroughs on every front in the peace process within 15 months. He aspires for peace with Syria and Lebanon and a final agreement with the Palestinians by October 2000. Now we come to the Sharm el-Sheikh memo. After weeks of tough negotiations and a weekend of brinkmanship, Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat signed a new West Bank Land for Security Agreement, charting the course toward an historic final peace accord by September 2000. Barak and Arafat signed the modified Y Memorandum, agreeing on a formula to implement the accord signed almost a year ago by the previous government. Under the new agreement, Israel and the Palestinians are to begin final status talks immediately with the aim of reaching a statement of principles on a final status in 5 months and the final status by September 2000. Events are now supposed to proceed rapidly. Within days, the army is to redeploy from 7% of the West Bank, transferring it from Israeli control, that's Area C, to Palestinian Civil Authority, that's Area B, and the release of 200 Palestinian security prisoners. Two more withdrawals are to take place on November 15, 1999, and January 20, 2000. And another batch of approximately 150 more security prisoners is to be released by or on October 8, 1999. During this time, the Palestinians will not declare a state. The southern safe passage route is to open October 1st, while the construction of the Gaza seaport is to commence on the same day. That safe passage route is safe passage between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, a safe passage highway or some kind of a roadway. Hamas, good old Hamas, dismissed the accord as another sellout by Arafat and received the right to resist Israeli occupation. So the Sharm el-Sheikh memorandum added to the Oslo Accords, the interim agreement or Oslo II, whatever you want to call it, dealt with release of prisoners, further redeployment of the IDF, and safe passage from the West Bank to Gaza. Well, final status talks finally resumed in September 13, 1999. This is again Israel Line, the Israeli consulate in New York. On the sixth anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Accord, Israel and the Palestinians officially renewed final status negotiations at the Eretz Junction. The timetable stipulated in the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement calls for a framework accord within 5 months and a treaty within a year, by September 13, 2000. The final status accord is intended to provide a solution to the three most difficult points of contention between Israelis and Palestinians: borders, refugees, and Jerusalem. At this point, the total area under PA civilian or civilian security control is 36% of the West Bank, comprising approximately 5,500 square kilometers. Support among the Palestinians for suicide attacks against Israel is waning, and support for the peace process has been rising steadily, according to the results of a Palestinian poll. Year 2000, Israel-Syria peace talks resume and then derail, followed by a German apology. In an historic speech to the Knesset, delivered in German, the first time that language has been spoken from the rostrum of the Israeli parliament, German President Johannes Rau declared yesterday, "I bow my head in humility before those who are murdered, those who have no graves at which I could ask their forgiveness." And this is the German President, Johannes Rau. Rau arrived in Israel Tuesday for a four-day visit, his first as president of Germany, although he visited the country many times in the past. Earlier in the day, Rau visited the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial, escorted by the institution's chairman, former Knesset speaker Sheva Weiss, a Holocaust survivor. The German president toured an exhibit of drawing and puppets made by children in Nazi death camps and laid a wreath. And this is as good a time as any to give you a little look at Yad Vashem. This is an overview of the compound. Quite an amazing compound. When you go to Israel, go to Yad Vashem. That's a must. So here's an overview of the compound. This is the Hall of Names. Here we're standing under the Great Dome that contains just a few of the 6 million people that were butchered by the Nazis. Real people. This is a German cattle car or a railroad car that hauled Jewish people, stuffed in there shoulder to shoulder to the death camps. And this is the Hall of the Eternal Flame. So, visit Yad Vashem. Next, we'll talk about the Eichmann Journals. Adolf Eichmann's diaries, written while he was on trial and later while awaiting his death sentence, were opened to the public on February 9, 2000, at the National Archive, at the same time that a copy headed for London to be presented as evidence in the case of historian David Irving's libel suit against American professor Deborah Lipstadt. And this is Eichmann in 1942. Israel's moral obligation to help defeat a lawsuit challenging the scope of the Holocaust outweighed strong misgivings about publishing the jailhouse memoirs of the Nazi technocrat who organized the transport of millions of Jews to their death in the concentration camps. Irving says he does not deny that the Jews were killed by Nazis, but he challenges the number and the manner of Jewish concentration camp deaths. Israel hopes the memoirs will provide more proof of the systematic killing of Jews by the Nazis, as well as the scope of the genocide. And this picture is of Eichmann on trial when he had been captured and returned to Israel. Of course, we read about that. We looked at that a short time ago. Now, according to Attorney General Rubenstein, Eichmann wrote that the killing of the Jews was the worst crime in the history of mankind. The Nazi leader also provided details on the workings of the death camps, as well as insight into the decision-making process of the Third Reich. He said he felt compelled to give his own account because, quote, I have seen hell, death, and the devil, because I had to watch the madness of destruction, because I was one of the many horses pulling the wagon and couldn't escape, left or right, because of the will of the driver. However, in an interview with a Dutch fascist journalist 5 years before his capture, 5 years before he was brought on trial in Israel, Eichmann expressed no such fondness for Jews or remorse for the Holocaust. Rather, he said he regretted that the Nazis had not been tougher executioners and sorry the Jews had managed to establish a state of their own in Israel. Yeah, real repentant, isn't he? All right, the multilateral negotiation track resumes after a 3-year pause and goes on hold again. The steering committee of the multinational negotiations of the Middle East peace process, in its special Moscow session, attended by foreign ministers, agreed on February 1, 2000, to officially renew the multilateral track. Official activities of this track were halted 3 years ago as a result of a decision taken by the Arab League. Israel was of the position that the multilateral talks constitute an integral part of the Madrid process and fulfill an important role in the peace negotiations. The renewal of the track will enable the entire region to prepare the institutional infrastructure required for an era of regional cooperation. But an Arab League meeting in Beirut, held after Israeli bombing raids, culminated in a call to the Arab states to delay a normalization process with Israel, including the multilateral negotiations. So on again, off again, on again, off again. That's why it's taking so long. That's why so many years are passing. All right, the IDF is now ordered out of Lebanon. Prime Minister Ehud Barak won unanimous cabinet backing for his oft-repeated promise to end Israel's long military presence in Lebanon. The decision, read by Cabinet Secretary Isaac Herzog, confirms, or I should say reaffirms, the government's goal of reaching an agreement with Syria that would facilitate a withdrawal, but emphasizes that Israel is determined to bring its troops back to the international border by July, even without Syria's blessing. Barak vowed to the ministers that the Israeli Defense Forces would be deployed along the international border with Lebanon by mid-year, and added that, I don't advise anyone to test our reaction once we're deployed there. So a thinly veiled threat, isn't it? Well, I want you to note some statements here. First of all, note that the Arab League blasted Israel's withdrawal plan. The Arab League was against it. In a joint statement, ministers of the 22-member League said they opposed a unilateral Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon and warned that such a move by Israel could lead to war. So on one hand, they say Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon could lead to war. And now they're saying Israel's unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon could lead to war. Kind of crazy, isn't it? So let's continue to note statements here. Their statement said the Arabs strongly condemned Israel occupation, the recent airstrike, and the vicious Israeli threats to destroy Lebanon. It defended the Lebanese guerrillas fighting in southern Lebanon, saying the resistance is a result of the occupation and not its cause. And so now the Israel wants to end the occupation. And now they're mad at Israel for ending the occupation. They're mad at Israel for occupying southern Lebanon and attacking Hezbollah. And now they're mad at Israel for leaving southern Lebanon. So in other words, Israel is damned if she does and damned if she don't. The obvious inconsistency of the Arab position reveals the self-serving nature and hypocritical attitude toward Israel that they possess. On April 5, 2000, an Israel Defense Forces official in the Northern Command confirmed that the IDF has begun making preparations for the withdrawal from southern Lebanon. Palestinian track reopens in D.C. Negotiating delegations from Israel and the Palestinian Authority began intensive talks on the final status agreement on March 22, 2000. The talks were held at Bolling Air Force Base close to Washington, D.C. The assessment in Washington is not a breakthrough in the talks, but rather that because of the level of these talks and the great difficulty of the issues involved, which is final status, borders, Jerusalem, the settlements, refugees, and water, the discussions are likely to continue as preparatory process for the tough decisions that the two sides will be asked to make. So no progress is being made. Everything is preparatory, preparatory, preparatory. For what? It never gets beyond that stage. All right, March 21st, 2000, Pope John Paul II visits Israel. Pope John Paul II arrived in Israel in a spiritual climax to his 22-year papacy. The pomp-filled ceremony was a vivid contrast to the previous visit by a pope in 1964, when Paul VI, during a 12-hour stay, kept his distance from Israeli leaders and never said the word Israel once. This is Pope John Paul III with Ehud Barak at Yad Vashem. So he's not keeping his distance from Israeli leadership, is he? Pope John Paul's six-day visit fulfills the pontiff's dream of visiting the sites where Christ was born and died, and caps his efforts to reconcile Jews and Catholics. And here's another picture of Pope John Paul II at the Western Wall. All right, March 21st, 2000, 6.1% of the West Bank is transferred to the Palestinian Authority. Israel handed over another 6.1% of the West Bank to the Palestinian Authority as part of the final stage of the second withdrawal. The transfer went off without a hitch. So you see, Israel is implementing the accords and giving back land step by step, releasing land step by step to the Palestinian Authority. The territories involved include a large chunk of territory around Hebron and slivers of areas near Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Yenin. The area around under PA control around Jericho was expanded. After the third stage redeployment of IDF troops scheduled for June, the Palestinian Authority will rule over 60% of the Palestinian population in the West Bank, around 1.7 million people, in 6.5% of the West Bank. The June redeployment will add an additional 340 square kilometers to Palestinian Authority territory. April 6, 2000, Israelis-Palestinians resume negotiations in Washington, D.C. April 10, 2000, Aliyah is up 35% in 1999. April 12, 2000, U.S. backs the Lebanon pullout plan. The Clinton administration welcomed Prime Minister Ehud Barak's plan to withdraw the Israeli Defense Force soldiers from southern Lebanon in July 2000. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright praised the decision to withdraw in response to to criticism from Arab states and said, now listen to Madeleine Albright, it's just so clear, it is strange, now this is a very mild way to put it, it is strange that a country is criticized for withdrawing from another country. Criticized for occupying that country, criticized for withdrawing that from that country. If you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Israel has always been under that situation. All right, Hezbollah harassment has begun on the northern border. Hezbollah fire aimed at IDF border bases is no accident. All the evidence suggests that the Katyusha fire yesterday was the start of a Hezbollah military campaign to harass the IDF as it withdraws from southern Lebanon. It's reasonable to expect that the pullout will be conducted amid Hezbollah attacks so that the IDF is made to appear as though it's retreating under fire. May 1st, 2000, permanent status talks resume. On again, off again, on again, off again. May 5th, 2000, northern border violence heats up. May 9th, 2000, population numbers, 6.3 million. Israel's population on its 52nd Independence Day is 6.3 million compared to a little under, compared to 6 million last year. Some 4.9 million citizens are Jews, 1.1 million are Arabs, and the rest are other minorities. May 15th, Nakba, catastrophe violence. I'm going to read a little bit out of an article in Israel, My Glory, the August-September issue in 2000. This is on page 4 of that issue. Israelis had observed their annual Independence Day celebration 52 years as a sovereign nation. In response, Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization announced, announced a special day of its own. It was called, it was dubbed Nakba Day, Day of Catastrophe. The catastrophe referred to was the day Israel officially joined the international community as a nation on May 14, 1948. To commemorate Nakba Day, Arafat ordered demonstrations that resulted in Palestinian rock throwing, Molotov cocktail showers, and Palestine police firefights with Israeli police and military. In the end, several lay dead and more than 350 were injured. And here's a slide of some of the Nakba demonstrations that went on. And you can see the key in the previous slide and the key here. The key has become a Palestinian symbol. It's the key to our homes. We're going to return to our homes and open the door with our keys. So I'm going to ask a relevant question here. Nakba. Is this the actions of a responsible peace-seeking leader in the Middle East negotiations? Arafat's men, Arafat's people, I'm sure under the approval of Arafat himself, thought this whole Nakba Day garbage up. You see, Arafat sees violence as a negotiation tool to prove his strength. Get the people rioting. And then everybody, the opposition, will shake and shudder and they'll give you anything if you tell them, well, I'll quiet the street. That's the Arafat's style. All right, May 16, 2000. PA arrests Israel's public enemy number one, a Palestinian militant suspected of having masterminded some of the bloodiest terror attacks against Israel in recent years, has been taken into custody by Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, according to Israeli and Palestinian sources. Mohammed Deif, I'm not sure exactly how that name is pronounced, Deif, widely regarded in Israel as public enemy number one, was arrested or gave himself up this month, in the Gaza Strip, where he had been a fugitive since his alleged role in a spree of suicide bombings in 1996. IDF withdrawals from Lebanon. SLA collapses. Israel's 18-year-long military presence in Lebanon came to an end on Tuesday, May 23, 2000, as the sudden collapse of the South Lebanon Army forced the IDF to conduct a hasty retreat from outposts throughout the security zone. Israel accepted as a UN regional group. The chief U.S. delegate to the United Nations, Richard Holbrooke, and this is Mr. Holbrooke, hailed Israel's acceptance as a temporary member of a UN regional group, opening the way for the country's eventual election to UN bodies after, listen to this, being barred for more than 40 years. So the UN voted Israel in as a fellow member and then bars her from activity in the UN for 40 years. That's a UN hypocrisy. Richard Holbrooke stated, "It is an historic step forward in the elimination of a huge injustice. Mr. Holbrooke said, "It goes to show that the UN is emerging into a new and, I hope, post-ideological phase of its existence, where the issues are dealt with on their merits." Well, that statement has all turned out to be wishful thinking. The UN is just as ideologically oriented as ever. Israel, until its acceptance as a full temporary member of the West European and Others Group, was the only member barred from UN's five regional groupings. Again, UN hypocrisy continues right down to this day. All right, July 2000, Camp David talks. Mid-East peace talks between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and U.S. presidential candidate, U.S. President Bill Clinton and Yasser Arafat collapsed on July 26th after 2 weeks of negotiations. Both sides knew it was an all-or-nothing situation. If the summit is a dead end, there will be war, a senior Israeli military official predicted. Robert Malley, Clinton staffer, shared the reason why the president went to Camp David. Quote, "The reason why we went to Camp David was that we had every indication that by September the Intifada was going to happen." You see, the battle for Jerusalem was pre-planned by Arafat before the Camp David summit. Participants agree that Clinton did a masterful job at negotiation and possessed a stunning knowledge of Jerusalem. However, Arafat kept pulling out new demands, and at the end, there wasn't any version that Arafat was prepared to accept. So Arafat made the decision to reject any all-embracing agreement. He had been promised, orally, 96% of the West Bank. Now here is a picture of the Camp David talks. Barak and Clinton and Arafat. And this is the Israeli proposal for the West Bank. The West Bank Israeli territory is in the yellow, the light color. You see that it is just a security zone along the Jordan River, and then access areas through the middle of the Palestinian territories to the west side where the roads met up with areas of significant Israeli settlement. The Palestinian territory is in green, light green, and dark green, 96%. The offer included incredibly far-reaching proposals besides the forfeiture of the West Bank. Barak was willing to divide Jerusalem and allow Arafat to proclaim the capital of his independent state to be in Jerusalem. And this is the Camp David 2000 proposal. The Jerusalem Israeli territory is the light-colored, yellow-colored, orange-colored, peach-colored area, whatever you want to call it. And the Palestinian territory is the bluish area. Palestinian control would have extended over the Muslim and Christian quarters of Jerusalem, including the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Palestinian control, but not sovereignty, would be granted over the Temple Mount. Arafat never offered a counter-proposal. He refused this. He turned this down and never offered a counter-proposal to anything. This behavior incensed President Clinton. Well, he didn't have a counter-proposal. He wanted to destroy Israel. So what's to talk about? This is all a facade, all hypocrisy on Yasser Arafat's part. Upon his return to Gaza, Arafat began speaking in inflammatory terms in Arabic about taking Jerusalem, while still talking peace in English. See how he does it? In Arabic, he talks war. In English, he talks peace. And the Intifada was fueled by such rhetoric. Well, the Al-Aqsa Intifada. How did the war begin? This is from the Jerusalem Post, October 4, 2002. A chronology of Palestinian moves leading up to the outbreak of violence shows it was planned in advance and ignited over the Jerusalem issue. A few days after the failure of the Camp David summit in July 2000, the Palestinian Authority's monthly magazine, Al-Shuhada, The Martyrs, published the following letter on July 25th. From the negotiating delegations at Camp David, led by the commander and symbol Abu Ammar, that's Yasser Arafat, to the brave Palestinian people, be prepared, the battle for Jerusalem has begun. The letter appeared in the aftermath of reports emanating from Camp David suggesting that the summit had failed because of Arafat's intransigence. According to PA sources, the letter was written by a senior Arafat advisor and approved by the PA chairman beforehand. The letter was published in a magazine distributed only among PA security personnel. It did not appear in any of the daily newspapers published in Jerusalem or Ramallah. Hence, the message Arafat was sending to his armed men was clear. Be prepared for an all-out confrontation from Israel because I refuse to accept Israeli and American dictates. As the Camp David summit was underway, Arafat's Fatah organization, the biggest faction of the PLO, started training Palestinian teenagers. They started training Palestinian teenagers for the upcoming violence in 40 training camps throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. PA appointed imams in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip mosques began referring to Israel as the Zionist enemy and urged all Muslims to mobilize for the war against the infidels. In the words of one Gazan preacher, all weapons must be aimed at the Jews, at the enemies of Allah, the cursed nation of the Quran, whom the Quran describes as monkeys and pigs, worshippers of the calf and idol worshippers. Other imams spoke of the need and duty to liberate Palestine from the Zionist aggressors. This time the talk was not only about liberating the West Bank and Gaza, now the demand was for Jerusalem, Jaffa, Haifa, Haifa and Ashkelon. Israel was also being accused of distributing drugs among young Palestinian men and women in order to corrupt them and bring about the disintegration of Palestinian society. In addition to the drugs, the Israelis were also believed to be behind sexually arousing chewing gum. Now this is wild, isn't it? Sexually arousing chewing gum found in Palestinian shops. So the Israelis planted that there, I suppose, by secret. The alleged goal is to turn Palestinian women into prostitutes. They want to defile our women with this sexually arousing gum. Wow. Well, I've heard crazier things than this out of the Palestinian Authority. An August 3rd poll conducted by the Independent Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research indicated that 2/3 of the Palestinians support a new intifada against Israel. This was the first time since the signing of the Oslo Accords that a majority of Palestinians said they supported violence against Israel. All right, I see I'm getting out of time, getting close to the end of my session. So let's do one more page here. September 28th, 2000, Likud Chairman Ariel Sharon visits the Temple Mount. Ariel Sharon announced his plans to visit the Temple Mount on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, a few days in advance of the visit. Israeli intelligence gathering resources had been informed. They determined that Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount would not generate unrest or disturbances. Public Security Minister Shlomo Ben Ami coordinated the visit with Yibril Rajub, the head of the PA Preventive Security Forces. Rajub told Ben Ami that if Sharon did not enter the mosque, there would be no reason for concern. Sharon would state later that he never intended to enter Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Dome of the Rock, either one. Security considerations had been examined with the conclusion that there was no reason to prevent the Likud chairman from visiting the site. So Mr. Sharon toured the Temple Mount surrounded by over 1,000 Israeli security troops. And here's an account, a picture of Likud chairman Ariel Sharon visiting the Temple Mount. Here he is at the Western Wall. He would ascend to the Temple Mount and tour the compound. All right, I see I'm out of time. So we will pick it up next session as the Al-Aqsa Intifada begins, also known as the Battle for Jerusalem. Thanks so much for joining us for this session. We always appreciate the fact that you're our students. We'll see you next session. Lahitraot. Lahitraot.